You were saying?
I don't tell you this to protect myself, but to add that being an alert person, it became easily apparent to me that something was going on in Washington policy circles and to some extent in our actions in Iran, which could only be part of a program to become increasingly offensive to Mossadegh. And there was a very fine man named Joe Upton, who was in INR, which is the intelligence research side. He had worked in Iran as an archaeologist. I believe he had perhaps been involved with OSS during the war. And he was a very wise, thoughtful, gentle person, unhappily long dead. I sat down with Joe Upton and said to him, and I don't recollect details, but basically I said to him, Joe, obviously something is going on, and I have an uneasy feeling that if indeed there is to be an overthrow of Mossadegh and the development of a new government, no one is putting any attention on what we do then. That the work right now is all, as far as we know, on the issue of how do you overthrow Mossadegh. And so he and I sat down and drew up what we called a what-if paper. What if Mossadegh fell? What would we do then? What would be required? And we didn't do this in an attempt to smoke out our superiors, but more than that, we were concerned that in fact something could happen and then everybody would stand around with their thumbs up their ears and say, oh, well, what now?
After some consequences.
Yeah. And I have no idea what happened to the what-if paper in terms of department's archives, but it was a formal paper which we submitted to Arthur Richards and which went on up the line. And indeed, after Mossadegh fell, I was present at a meeting in Dulles' office, the secretary's office, and he had, at that time, he had Flager, who was his legal counsel, and Dulles did hardly anything without the legal counsel involved, and Byrod, I remember, and Arthur Richards, and, well, the policy people, I...
Policy planning staff people?
Yeah, there were, say, 10 people. Yeah. And they were sitting around, and indeed they were working to some extent from my paper. And I remember there was some discussion. Dulles was not very interested, in my recollection. But the question was how much money to give to Zahedi. And I think Byrod asked for, say, 20 million, and somebody else said, oh, God, you know, we don't have that, and we don't have anything. And so Dulles said, how about 10 million? And everybody said, okay. And that was, so you have these, to me, not untypical, they're typical decisions. I think that Beadle Smith decided to dump Mossadegh in a brief interview with some CIA officers. And I think that Dulles decided to start passing money to Zahedi in a very casual meeting. Now that doesn't mean that a whole lot of people weren't working constantly like me, but again I come back to these concerns that there was some very carefully calculated policy. I really don't think that our policy on Iran was worked out, certainly not on the basis of any conspiracy, but on the basis of sort of, well, Jesus, what do we do now? Oh, okay, you know, let's get rid of him. Well, okay, now let's, oops, oh, now, well, okay, we got to give him some money. Well, what do we intend to do? Okay. And then the workers go to work, Henderson and the others. Now, Henderson's role, having said that I believe he was deeply reluctant, Henderson's role was, nonetheless, to carry out policy, and he very carefully developed an attitude and helped to sponsor an attitude in Iran that Mossadegh was leading the country to ruin and to communist control. Whether Henderson believed that or not, I don't know. But that's certainly the way he worked. And he did it, including removing himself from the scene. I don't remember the exact timing, but it seems to me he was out of Iran.
On vacation, I think.
And of course, so unlike Mr. Henderson to take a holiday right in the middle of a crisis. All of these things were worked out. I don't think these were things that Kim Roosevelt cooked up in a back room. I think these were things that Mr. Henderson and Roosevelt and others worked out. But it was no doubt in my mind that there was a carefully developed, coordinated State Department CIA plan leading toward the eventual overthrow of Mossadegh.
Okay, yeah, this all raises a lot of questions. I want to backtrack a little bit, just a little bit. Now, how much in the period when you were still in Tehran, 51, 52, mm-hmm. how much concern was there at the embassy about the influence of the Tuda, the local communist party or movement?
Well, a great deal. In a curious way, more when I first arrived than when I left. Because in 1949, when I arrived, it was very fresh in all our minds that the communists, the Russians, had attempted to hold on to Azerbaijan after the war, and that it was only through a struggle in international courts or in the UN, and then a terrific struggle within Iran. And in my dispatch on the Shah, I have as an enclosure a letter which Jack Jernigan wrote.
Yeah.
No, a reply to a letter which Jack Jernigan wrote, written by Allen, Ambassador Allen. And that letter is a marvelous description of how the Shah reached a point where he took a decisive action which led to the fall of Gavam, which had an effect on the Azerbaijani problem, mm-hmm. and which supported the idea that the Shah could be a reliable leader and a reliable pro-Western leader. So that when I arrived in 49, the Tuda was still viewed as a danger, because it had been damn near successful in dismembering a part of Iran. Whether that was an accurate appraisal of the actual strength of the Tuda, I don't know. And I think that by the time the National Front came in, the concerns that the Tuda was, first of all, an influence within the National Front, and then the concerns that the Tuda was an opposition to the National Front, then there'd be concerns that the Tuda would be the heir of the National Front. I don't remember any serious details, certainly not scholarly study of those issues. There may be some in the CIA files, but I don't remember any State Department.
In one document I've seen, or seen referred to, was an October 52 CIA analysis suggesting or estimating that the Tuda lacked the capacity to overthrow the government. Was it a government?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
That was a commonly held assumption.
Oh, yeah. Now, that time.
Yeah. Now, some historians have argued that the embassy tended to overestimate the Tuda's strength in the country, and also also overestimated the degree to which, at some stages, the Tuda was cooperating implicitly or tacitly with the National Front. Was the Tuda strength overestimated in some ways in reports back to Washington?
Well, as my last comment indicated, I don't really remember the embassy being especially concerned about the Tuda after the National Front came to power, except for the sense that in a complete disarray, the Tuda could become heirs of power. But there, I think the concern ran more to the Soviet neighbor and the Soviet influence than it did to a serious nationwide, deeply ingrained Tuda force. That's my feeling.
Now, from what I've read, this article here, which I'll show you later, Apparently the CIA had penetrated the Tudor party at the very highest levels. Was this something that you knew about?
No, I didn't.
No. Now, in the fall of 51, Mossadegh spent about 6 weeks in the U.S., where he presented his case on nationalization to the U.N.,
mm-hmm.
and met the great lines with Addison and George McGee to continue discussions on the oil question and work out a basis for a compromise
mm-hmm.
with the British. And the newly elected conservative government in Britain rejected the compromise that McGee and Mossadegh worked out
mm-hmm.
back in Washington. Well, like staying at the Shoreham Hotel, and there's many discussions being held there. And I guess the British rejected the compromise because it still left nationalization intact. The British conservative government rejected any prospect of agreeing on the principle of nationalization. Do you know if Acheson tried to apply any pressure on Eden and the British conservatives to get the British to accept some kind of a compromise plan that was being worked out in Washington at this stage?
I have no personal knowledge of that. I may have been aware of it, but I don't remember anything like that. I don't remember preparing any papers which he would have used. I'm talking to Eden.
Okay. Now, apparently by around January 52, from what I've read, Acheson was concluding it was likely that no settlement would be reached with Mossadegh. Was the thinking at the embassy around this time, early 52, pretty much along the same lines, it would be very likely that there'd be no settlement
now, Mossadegh? Let's see, January 52, when did Eisenhower take power?
This is still a year before
before
the Republicans coming in.
And when did Harriman come out?
51?
Was it 51?
Yeah, this is 7 months later, I guess. Yeah.
Well, again, my recollection, without any reference to notes or anything, or chronology, is that Acheson and his senior advisors, Nitzer was one of them.
That's right, obviously.
They never quit trying to negotiate with Mossadegh. That's my recollection. It's possible that I'm looking back with a long telescope, but I think that I had the feeling that it was almost pathetic. These very senior men, they get so excited. I'm not talking about Acheson, but Nitzer was an active man. There was an economic assistant secretary then.
Thorpe?
No, somebody out of New York. Anyhow, they were all like children, and they'd get all excited, and then wonderful, you know, and they'd be out there going to solve a world problem. And I may just make this up as I think back, but my own recollection is that they were pathetic, these men. Compared to someone like Henderson, who was so steady and so long-term. So if Mr. Acheson did feel that it was a useless proposition, he certainly, it seems to me, he did not stop his people, his Hank Byrod, whom I like. Hank Byrod was a good chief. But these guys would get together, and they had a thrill. It was like fighting the war for them.
I read also around the same time, by late 51, early 52, that Ambassador Henderson was trying to get the Shah to replace Mossadegh with someone who was more readily agreeable on a compromise with oil question, on the oil question with the British. Did you know much of what Henderson was thinking at this stage?
I don't remember that. I think it's very natural that Henderson would have discussed with the Shah the possibility of getting somebody in.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. Does it say who his candidate was?
I think it was...
Was it Zahidi then?
No, it was early. It was somebody else. Hussein Allah, I think.
Everybody loved old Hussein Allah. He's a sweet man and had done such a good job on the Azerbaijani issue. My answer is I don't really have a knowledge of it.
Yeah. Now, why did you leave Iran for your assignment in Washington?
Oh, Lord. Had to be in...
Sometime in 52.
Had to be in 52.
I guess I was there a year and a half, 49 to 50, 51. I would say in early 52. In any case, I was in Washington on the desk while Acheson was still secretary. So it had to be in 52 at the latest.
So you returned to Washington to serve as principal officer, as desk officer?
Is
that immediate? You were doing that right away?
Yeah, I was transferred directly from Tehran, and I had home leave because I'd, you know, after you were abroad, a minimum of 2 years. So I had a month's home leave and then went to the desk. And at that time, the desk officer was Vaughn Ferguson, who's now dead. And shortly after I joined him, then he moved on to another job, and I became the great title of officer in charge of Iranian affairs.
Okay. Who else worked at the desk? Did you have an assistant?
Yes. There was somebody in the economic section. Oh, Lord, I hadn't thought about these. And there was somebody else who was in my own office. I'm ashamed to say I don't remember any names.
Maybe they'll come to mind as we go on. Now, who were some of the other officials?
But looking upward, it was Arthur Richards. I mean, the partnership between me and Arthur Richards had been formed in Iran, and we just kept on going on the desk. I don't think there was any, I don't think I had much of a staff. There was an economic section in GTI, and there was a man in that section who dealt with Iranian affairs. It seems to me his name was Crowell, Bernie Crowell, C-R-O-W-L, something like that.
Now, around this time, 52, early 53, say, who are the other agencies would work on Iranian issues? For example, the Defense Department or Treasury, Justice, because they had an interest in the question of antitrust in oil companies.
All right. Well,
or CIA for that matter.
Yeah. At my level, desk officer, my partner in INR was Joe Upton. And of course, INR is the direct liaison with the intelligence community, the CIA. Nonetheless, at the same time, I had both old friendships and also official relations with Roger Guérin, who was then the CIA director for Middle East covert action, and John Waller, who was his assistant, dealing primarily with Iran. I knew Kim Roosevelt, but I was in no way involved with him at that time. So, informally, I would be in touch with the two CIA principals at my bureaucratic level, and also socially, I saw them. Upton, within the State Department. Now, you ask about the military. I don't remember having much in the way of a connection to Defense Department people. They certainly were represented from time to time in large groups, but in terms of day-to-day or even weekly contacts, I don't remember picking up the phone and checking in with somebody in the Defense Department. Obviously, Henderson had military attachés, and there was a military mission. Treasury, again, I don't remember any particular involvement with Treasury at my level, although at very senior levels, obviously, there would be representatives from Treasury, particularly when you were talking about oil. Now, the Justice Department, the only time that I saw a direct involvement was, and I have no idea the date, there was a summons by the President, and I think by this time Herbert Hoover Jr. was Under Secretary, so I'm talking about that time. I may be mistaken. Anyhow, there was a gathering of senior representatives of American oil companies in the State Department, and they met in a conference room up in the Secretary's area, and I was present. And I know that there was a great deal of prior clearance with the Justice Department, which had to be satisfactory to the oil companies before they stepped in the same room. And that was done. But that was not done at my level.
Now, how would you describe your responsibilities as a principal officer?
Desk
as desk officer, yeah, or whatever?
Principal officer would be a term for somebody in overseas.
Okay.
No, I was officer in charge.
That's what I meant.
Officer in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
Of Iran for a desk. Well, it meant that on a daily basis, well, first of all, it meant that that's all I thought about, aside from my family. It meant that on a daily basis, I dealt with all reports from the embassy, all requests for response from the embassy, and all directives sent to the embassy, either by doing them myself or by clearing them. It meant that I was a source of information to anybody senior to me in the department, which includes most of the department, although by then I'd risen rather quickly in the service, but I was still a desk officer, just a desk officer. I was the source of information to people in the Security Council they'd have meetings which they would work on the Iranian policy issue. Well, I would be called to supply papers and to provide information to people working at that level, or I would be constantly summoned up to the Assistant Secretary's office. And then, of course, during the night, in those days, what we had in the State Department were watch officers. And a telegram would come in, which the watch officer would think significant enough to call me and waken me. I would get my car and drive down and read it. And if I thought it was important enough, I would even wake a senior officer up, but generally I wouldn't. I would then go to work on it first thing in the morning. That's what I did.
Yeah. Now, during this period, the CIA wrote estimates on the Iranian situation. I have one here, a little Xerox copy, of prospects for survival of Mossadegh regime in Iran, dated October 1452, produced, I guess, at their offices in Washington.
Yeah.
Do you know who wrote the estimates? Who in their staff would write these?
No.
I guess they're called National Intelligence Estimates, NIEs.
And no, I wasn't on distribution.
Yeah. Oh, you weren't?
No.
At the desk?
No.
Who in the department, the State Department, worked closely or followed closely the oil issues, oil policy issues?
Well, I think for one thing, Walter Levy was on a continuing consultant basis.
Uh-huh.
For another thing, of course, the very senior people, such as Flager, who after all had been the legal counsel for Sun Oil here, maybe Standard Cal, I don't know. And then the economic section, the Assistant Secretary for Economic Affairs. Those were people who dealt with that sort of thing. I don't remember any oil company ever either calling me or coming to see me. But when they had their meetings and when we worked out policies, I would of course be informed, or any instruction that went to the embassy I'd get a copy, or indeed it would pass through my hands. The State Department, when I talked to you about not being on the distribution list for CIA data, that's not unusual. The CIA, after all, supplies its information first of all to its own principals, but then to a control channels to the State Department. So there'll be a senior officer in the INR, intelligence research area, who would then presumably make the decision whether or not it would reach me, I guess.
Maybe Upton would see it, perhaps, because he was an INR.
Perhaps,
yeah.
Perhaps, although not necessarily. But, and I'm not saying I didn't see some of their stuff, but I certainly was not on a routine distribution. In other words, it wouldn't come direct across to me. It would pass through their control channels, which I think is correct.
Okay. Do we call who Iran's ambassador in Washington was at this stage when you were desk officer, 52?
God, I don't.
Yeah. Did you have much dealing with the embassy, with their embassy?
I remember social relationships more than I do official relationships. Yes, of course we did. We had all kinds of conversations, but not on policy issues. And I don't think that we, the State Department, used the Iranian ambassador much as a channel to Mossadegh.
Also just through Henderson.
It was through Henderson, yeah.
Now, in February 52, the World Bank Vice President, Robert Garner, headed another attempt to reach a settlement on an oil issue. He traveled to Iran, met with Mossadegh and the embassy staff to try to forge a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall or do you know how closely Garner coordinated his efforts with the State Department?
I don't know. Let's see, who was that? Was Grady still there?
Probably Henderson. I guess it'd be Henderson. Early 52.
It'd be Henderson.
Yeah.
Well, again, knowing Mr. Henderson, he would not have let Garner just travel around loose. He would have been closely involved. But I don't remember any particular experience that's worth remembering, worth telling you about.
Okay. Now, during this period, the U.S. is still providing some aid to Iran. It was providing 0.4 technical assistance.
That's right, yeah.
Plus military assistance program, MAP aid, as it was called then.
Yeah.
But there was no general purpose economic assistance, no balance of payment support or whatever. Did Mossadegh make many requests for aid to the U.S. For general support?
I don't remember any. I have no idea. Again, I just keep hitting this drum, but it's basic to all of this, in my opinion.
Uh-huh.
Mossadegh wasn't counting pennies. Mossadegh was counting on the United States to buy his oil to protect him from the Russians and to kick the British out. I'm just convinced of that. But whether the old man ever said, I'd like to have another $10 million to build roads or something, I don't remember anything like that. His people may have mentioned it. Certainly he had around him some pretty grasping types who may have wanted money, but I don't remember Mossadegh really discussing seriously with us economic aid.
Okay. Now, by June of 52, from what I've read, Henderson was giving quiet support to Mohammad Kavan as a replacement for Mossadegh. Would it be fair to assume that he was doing this with the full knowledge of the State Department, with the higher-ups, like Acheson or Acheson's deputies?
Certain. Henderson never made a significant move without having it either cleared in advance or informing them.
Uh-huh.
But again, I don't remember. I was startled when you told me that Kavan was even in the play then. He was an old geezer by then.
You had contact with him when you were in Tehran.
Socially.
Now, in July 52, Mossadegh had a struggle with the Shah over control of the military. And Mossadegh briefly resigned as prime minister and was temporarily replaced by Kavan for 5 or 6 days.
Yeah.
But Kavan was only temporarily in power because there was massive street protests in Tehran forcing Kavan to resign. And Mossadegh was put back in power, reappointed. This might have been at a higher level of discussion at this stage, but did the U.S. government have any plans or proposals to support Kavan politically or financially so he could keep his power as prime minister?
As far as I know, there was nothing in place as far as I know.
Okay. Now, for the early 1950s, maybe even the late 1940s, the CIA had a covert program in Iran called BEDAN, B-E-D-A-M-N, which this article I gave you by Gorevsky discusses. And probably the basic purpose of BEDAN was to counter the influence of the Tuda, the Soviet Union in Iran. Did you know about this program's existence? It's only come to light recently, apparently.
No, I did not. But I did know, of course, that there were American intelligence personnel in Iran. I also knew then, and still know, that a good deal of our work in Iran was really directed north to the neighbor there.
Okay.
One of my great happy memories is there was a man, he was an army officer, but on the intelligence side, named Gagarin. I think he's still alive, but I think he's in Brazil.
America.
Alex Gagarin, yes, American, out of a great Russian family, of course, but And he retired. He lived in Washington for a while. And they gave a Russian Easter party. And Archie Roosevelt was there. Now, he's the man whose wife was or may still be the chief of protocol
at
the State Department.
So,
and at one point during the rather bibulous occasion, Gagarin and Archie Roosevelt put their arms around each other and sang the Azerbaijani national anthem, remembering their happy days when they were intelligence officers, American officers, up there in Azerbaijan, helping to get the Russians out. So, sure, I knew of American intelligence operations in Iran, but as I say, I always thought of them, except for the business with most of them, I always thought of them as primarily concerned with external affairs.
Uh-huh.
And certainly while the British were running Iran, the American intelligence agencies were not, I'm convinced, we're not trying to overthrow or control any governments in Iran.
Uh-huh.
The British would have squashed them.
Yeah, apparently, after the British were forced out in late 52, apparently. They were forced, they had to leave their embassy staff.
Sure.
The embassy staff had to leave Iran.
Yeah.
Their intelligence people had to leave the country, lock, stock, and barrel. And by this point, by the fall of 52, apparently the Badam program also started to target the National Front. The idea was, so I've read, was to create or exacerbate internal divisions in the front to separate its leadership from its mass social base. And the ultimate goal apparently was to undermine or destabilize most of ex-government. Was there any word in Washington about this kind of a program? Or?
Well, I wasn't personally familiar with it. It makes sense to me. I think it's very reasonable that what you said is true. But I don't know.
Now, in November 52, C.M. Woodhouse, who you mentioned earlier, of the British SIS, was sent to Washington to seek U.S. support for a tentative plan to overthrow Mossadegh. He discussed this in his memoirs. Apparently, Woodhouse met with some State Department officials. Would this, again, have been the people at the Assistant Secretary level that he would have met with? Or did you know about his arrival in Washington?
My guess is in his memoirs, when he says State Department officials, he means CIA.
Well, he discusses it as a separate category for CIA.
Does he?
So I guess he went to the department offices.
Because it's like Kim, you know, Kim Roosevelt had to withdraw the first run of his book on counter-coup because the British objected to some of his references. Well, no, my answer is no. I knew Woodhouse in Iran, and I may have seen him socially when he came to Washington, although I don't remember it. But certainly I was not involved in any negotiations or discussions.
Okay. Now, around this time, before the British were expelled, they were working with the Rassidian brothers and General Zahidi in a plan to overthrow Mossadegh. The British had this ongoing circle of people that they were working with.
Yeah.
With the aim of overthrowing the Prime Minister. Did you know the Rashidian brothers when you were in Tehran? Were they people you might have, you know, no social contact
with? Well, they were merchants in the bazaar, and they were known as influential people, but no. Again, you're asking me about things had to do with covert activities, and believe me, junior officers in an embassy don't...
They were not in the loop, as they say these days, right?
No, and they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Okay. Now, in January 53, there was a final effort to work out a compromise on the oil question. This effort had started under Acheson, made under Acheson, and was presented to Mossadegh early that year as one of the last acts, I guess, of the Truman administration as was leaving the scene. And Mossadegh turned down the plan, which the U.S. had offered. Apparently, one of the reasons that Mossadegh turned the plan down was that the British had insisted that the compensation for nationalization would take into account not only the value of AIOC's properties in Iran, but also the future earnings that AIOC would be deprived of through nationalization, future profits based upon its long-term contract with the government of Iran. Was this question discussed at the desk, this question of the compromise plan? The British assistance about future earnings being compensated?
there.
I'm sure it was. Yeah. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that would have been
yeah.
kept in a secret,
yeah. Yeah.
In a special category.
Yeah.
But I don't remember.
Did you do any work on this compromise plan yourself? Would you have been involved in drafting it or
yes,
putting it together?
Well, I suppose so. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
day-to-day work, which would range from the most pedestrian thing, like somebody trying to locate an American child taking a bus across Iran to uh-huh. to working on Security Council issues or National Security Council
uh-huh.
issues.
Uh-huh.
But I just don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Now, at this time, the Eisenhower administration was coming into power, early 53.
Mm-hmm.
How would you characterize the approach that Eisenhower and Dulles took to Iran in this very early stage?
Well, I've already indicated
to some extent, yeah,
one
yeah.
specific thing. In, if I can reduce it to the question of attitude toward Mossadegh rather than attitude toward Iran,
okay.
I can speak with some authority.
Right.
And there, as I indicated, I believe that the decision was transmitted by Beadle Smith to the CIA officers in an official fashion in Beadle's office to dump Mossadegh. And that Beadle was at that time speaking for not only his president and his boss, but also his former boss, Alan Dulles.
Uh-huh. How would you explain that decision? Well, how would you explain the basis for this hostility to Mossadegh?
Oh, I think two bases. One is a more realistic, at least in my opinion, a more realistic assessment of whether you could negotiate with Mossadegh.
Uh-huh.
And a decision to just sweep him off the board. That's one aspect. The other aspect is the Republicans who came in. Foster Dulles is one of the most disagreeable, tough-minded people I've ever known, and I knew him pretty well. I delivered the top secret morning report to him. This is when I was in his secretariat. Every morning I would hand it to him personally for a year, and he never said good morning to me or anything. I might have been the heir. I mean, this is a man who, many other people have made these comments, this is a man who was a very realistic, a very, very cold fellow. And Alan Dulles, who had a lot more charm, nonetheless was also a very cool customer. And President Eisenhower, after all, commanded one of the great coalitions in military history, and despite his grin, could be a very tough boy. And those men, with Beadle Smith, those four men, those are very tough customers. They're a quantum leap from kids like Nitze and people like Byrd, for that matter, who just, oh God, they just loved the excitement. The world was their playpen, and they just moved things around and so on. And unhappily for us, that didn't happen again until Kennedy brought in his crowd of young people again, and they treated the world the same way with equally, well, no, more disastrous results, because I would say Acheson's work stood to the test of time very well. But so that's the other basis. We had in charge of foreign policy some very tough customers who did not think of the world as a playpen. They thought of the world as a very serious place, and if somebody was giving you trouble, you knocked them off one way or another. Those are the two reasons.
How did fear of communism enter into their calculations about the situation in Iran?
I don't think a lot.
They were not that concerned about the two parties?
Well, I don't think they even knew what the, well, certainly they did, I suppose, but I don't think Foster Dulles or Eisenhower gave a damn about the Tudor Party, but they were conscious, of course, of strategic global considerations, naturally. But I think they were just fed up with this guy. You know, let's push him aside. They didn't want to kill him.
His memoir.
Push him aside and let's move on. Let's
let's stop all this.
Settle oil business.
Yeah, I'm sure the oil business had an element, and certainly the British, you know, Eden and Acheson didn't get on at all. Well, Eden and Dulles got on wonderfully. I mean, despite the fact that Eden and Acheson looked alike and came from the same kind of background.
They got along well, because I've seen their correspondence at Yale. It seems very friendly in its tenor. Yeah. Well, maybe later on they...
I don't think so. I think they had a hard time with each other. Yeah, but in any case, the British and Eisenhower got on just fine. After all, Eisenhower had spent four rather significant years working very closely with him and so on. So I would say the British, probably by this time, they also had more realistic people in charge of those affairs, and I think it was just a concatenation of people who were prepared to take a new and realistic look at Iran, and they saw Mossadegh as a problem.
Uh-huh. Now, in his memoirs, C.M. Woodhouse discusses his visits to Washington, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, and he suggests that he played up the anti-communist aspect, the fear of communism, with the CIA people and the State Department people in order to get them to take a stronger interest in the British plan to overthrow Mossadegh. What is that? Does that make sense to you, that this sort of, that the British might have played up the role of anti-communism to encourage American interests to support their goals of restoring...
The Americans in those years twitched when you said the word communist, and with some good reason, but certainly the Eisenhower people that came to power on an expression of almost a suggestion that the Democrats had been traitors at Yalta and so on. And so that, sure, that was a good button to push. But again, I'm speaking without any personal knowledge of these men's thinking, but my feeling is that the main thing that happened was you had a whole new crowd in, and the top men were very tough, very realistic, and did not want to play games with the world. And the other is they faced a table loaded with failed negotiations of all kinds, of good faith negotiations, and they just didn't want to do any more of that. So the two things came together.
Yeah.
The communist element, sure, it was part of it, but I think it can be over-exaggerated.
That's interesting. Now, you mentioned earlier that you had gotten sort of got a sense that something was going on with in terms of American planning to overthrow Mossadegh. You prepared a paper, sort of a what-if paper.
Yeah.
Can you recall the date of the month?
No.
When
did Mossadegh fall?
August, mid-August, 53.
Well, this would have been in midsummer of 53, I guess.
This would have done this paper.
Yeah. I don't mean that I embarrassed my chief, Arthur Richards, by insisting on being informed, but I must admit I would say, come on, you know, it's something going on that I don't know about. And men like Jack Jernigan and Byrod were both friends as well as superiors. And they wouldn't say anything to me. Then there was a guy named...
So Richards wouldn't tell you anything either?
No, because...
Wall, basically. Yeah.
I mean, it was part of the rule.
Yeah.
I mean, the line was drawn at the assistant secretary, and then it shifted down eventually to the office director, and that was it.
Okay.
But on the other hand, it became increasingly apparent that something was going on. And Fraser Wilkins, who was then... He's still alive in Washington. Yeah. Fraser Wilkins was then an officer in the Policy Planning Council. And he felt that something was going on, and he leaned hard on me, which was his mistake. And I kept saying to him, why don't you talk to Jack Jernigan, who was a personal friend and contemporary colleague. So, and Fraser has never forgiven me for not telling him. And I keep saying to him, Fraser, I didn't know. Anyhow, that's when Upton and I decided that something was going on that could lead to a change of government, and somebody ought to be thinking about that.
Okay. Let me try to...